So in the early 1980s, I worked for one of those three-letter federal government agencies that you're not allowed to talk about outside of work. We were at the height of the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union were toe-to-toe, creating all kinds of mischief for one another across the global landscape. And the role of the intelligence community was to use the authorities that we had been given by Congress to acquire information that would not otherwise be known and make that information available to U.S. government decision makers to help them in their task. And that was my job when I first started in the early 1980s in the intelligence community. And I started with all these terrible briefings that they give you in which they threaten you with the implications of failing at your job or creating an unauthorized disclosure of classified information. I mean, in the orientation, when they tell you that death penalty is possibly a human resources outcome of one of your actions, it's very crystallizing, and it makes you pay attention to what you're doing, and it may explain why I was so rigid in the processes that I followed. So the information is only of value if you can actually deliver it to somebody, and typical customers were executive branch agencies and senior leaders of those agencies, and certainly the military was a primary customer of ours. And the types of information that we would share with them were about what you would expect: movements of military forces in foreign countries, hostile threats that may exist to U.S. interest overseas, espionage activities aimed at the U.S., all the sort of national security stuff that you would expect. The key was to get it to those people in a timely and actionable manner. Now think about it. It's early 1980. Many of you were not born then. That's fine. I'll explain it to you. A lot of the technology that we have today, and that frankly we very much take for granted, did not exist or did not exist widely in the early 1980s. Cell phones, computers, what a horrible world. Texting, the ability to send email, the ability to ship files around. And so how is it possible for us to provide timely, actionable information to decision makers in Washington, D.C.? Well, we took an example from the Pony Express, and I was one of those Pony Express riders. So every morning when I would come in, I had five or six customers in the D.C. area that I was responsible for supporting. I would visit them on regularly scheduled days at very specific times. They knew I was coming. So I would come into work in the morning. I would pull out all of the traffic that came in overnight. I would sort it out into little piles for each of the agencies that I was visiting. I would wrap them following some very specific and arcane procedures, stuff them into a locked canvas bag, and exit the building where a motor pool vehicle was waiting for me, that was my horse, to ride me around to these locations so I could deliver this information to these decision makers. Now, that seems arcane given the speed of information, but in the 1980s, the early 1980s, the speed of information wasn't that great. All of our adversaries had the same information sharing challenges, so we could move at a more deliberate pace and still meet the goal. I would arrive at these customer locations and usually be met at the door by the one or two people who were authorized to see the information. They would walk me around bypassing all the security procedures and the turnstiles, and we would go back into their building, typically into a very small locked room, not much larger than literally a broom closet. And I would unpack the information and spread it out for them to read. And read was all that they could do, because we were not in a space that was authorized to conduct a discussion of highly classified information. So it became this sort of weird mime where they'd be holding something up and pointing at it and raising their eyebrows and gesticulating in all manner to demonstrate for me that this was valuable, we'd like more of this. And I would take a few notes. When they were done, I'd pack the information up, seal it back in that canvas bag, go out, meet my driver, and go to my next stop. So that was my job. Kind of routine, kind of boring, but boring was okay. We got good stuff done. I mean, right, we won the Cold War. Everything's great now, right? So that worked out really well. So it was a fairly predictable pattern until one day in the afternoon, we got a phone call. There was an extraordinarily sensitive piece of intelligence that indicated there was a very serious threat to an overseas activity that was part of an organization called the United States Information Agency. Brief sidebar, U.S. Information Agency created in 1954 with the sole purpose of educating the foreign public about America, American policy, and American culture. So think about Voice of America and those sorts of activities, foreign language broadcast of U.S. information. So this information was so perishable it needed to be acted on immediately. And the individuals who could take action on it in the overseas location where the problem was potentially going to be already had the information. It was decided that the director of the U.S. Information Agency should be briefed on this information immediately. He was the only person who could see it because he was the only person who had the clearance and authorization to see this information. This is a customer we had never visited before. They had no experience with us. They didn't know who we are. We were just going to show up out of nowhere with this highly sensitive information and ask to see the director of the agency. Now, the director of the U.S. Information Agency at the time was no ordinary director. He was a personal friend of then-President Ronald Reagan. And so the security and privacy bubble around Charles Wick, the head of the U.S. Information Agency, was a little bit tighter than many of his predecessors had ever experienced. So I packed up the information, ran down to get in the car. My boss was going to call ahead of me, it's about a 30-minute trip, and vet me into the building so that I would immediately be taken up to see Mr. Wick, could share the information with him, and get out of his busy day. So the driver dropped me off across the street from the entrance to the building. I got out of the car in my trench coat, of course, carrying my locked, nondescript canvas bag, and I went into a phone booth. Now, do I have to explain that to anyone? If you Google it, because I was to call Mr. Wick's office, let them know I was here so that I could then move across the street and be expedited in the building. So imagine this phone conversation. Mr. Wick's office, may I help you? This is Mr. Murphy from the Department of Defense. I'm here to see Mr. Wick. I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please? Mr. Wick is expecting me. I need to see him immediately on an urgent matter. Hold the line, please. Another voice gets on. Hello, I'm on Mr. Wick's personal staff. Can I help you? Yes, I'm here to see Mr. Wick. Okay. And who are you? Mr. Murphy from the Department of Defense. Mr. Wick is expecting to see me. This is an urgent matter. I need to see him immediately. Another voice gets on the line. Hello, can you tell me where you're calling from? And I remember whispering. I don't know why I whispered, but I said, I'm in the phone booth across the street. And I swear, I'll bet everyone in that suite got up, leaned, looked out the window, and said, oh, my God, there's a nut in the phone booth down there, and I think he has a bomb. So they continued to put different people on the phone, and I'm talking to them. And then suddenly I realized they had come to their senses, because I'm thinking, these people are imbeciles. Don't they know who I am? These two guys in suits come out of the front of the building, and instead of crossing the street directly toward me, they went diagonally until they were on opposite sides of me on my side of the street, and they came toward me standing in the phone booth. One guy flashed a badge and said, sir, would you mind putting that bag down and stepping out of the phone booth? I am not letting go of this bag. This bag is staying with me at all times. Sir, are you armed? And so I opened my coat and said, no, because that would be like crazy, right? So they said, why don't you come with us across the street? And I was like, finally, we're getting some action here. So they walked me gingerly across the street, keeping a safe distance. As soon as we get in the door, there's a magnetometer and an x-ray machine. And they want the bag on the x-ray machine and me in the magnetometer. And I said, not happening. You will not x-ray this bag. And again, it's me worried about the death penalty. You will not x-ray this bag. I'll walk through the magnetometer with the bag, which of course set off all the bells and whistles. So they were... Literally, I think people in the lobby were like this behind their furniture when I walked in, because clearly there was some nut coming in the building. So they took me down the hallway to this rather nondescript building. It actually reminded me of the interrogation room on The Wire. I kept waiting for Bunk and McNulty to come in. And they kept asking what to them were probably perfectly reasonable questions, and I was giving them perfectly ambiguous and not satisfying answers. This went on for way too long, and I could see the tension level and the nervousness of these fellows who probably thought they were going to die in that room today, elevating. Well, finally, there was a knock on the door, and a hand reached in a piece of paper, and the one agent took it. He looked at it. He looked at me. He looked at it. He looked back at me. He said, are you Mr. Murphy? I said, yes, I told the person I talked to on the phone across the street. Come with me. So quietly, he led me to the elevator, went up to the top floor. As soon as I went into the suite, all eyes were like following me like laser beams. I was taken into Mr. Wick's office. The door was closed. I unpacked the information. I let him read it only, couldn't talk about it. He appreciated the sharing of the information. And I thought, these people are morons. How can we ever support a customer like this who doesn't appreciate the value of the service that we're providing? We're giving him actionable information with which to make important, responsible decisions. So I got back in the car, and I went back to the office. And I started right off the bat with my boss. I said, you wouldn't believe what happened when I got down there. He goes, yeah, yeah. He says, I'm sorry. I called, and the number was busy. So I thought, I got 30 minutes. He went to the cafeteria to get a sandwich, and he ran into an old friend. And they sat down and forgot all about this gangly 20-year-old in a trench coat who was putting his life at risk to deliver information to the head of the U.S. Information Agency. Incredible. He finally did remember that he was supposed to call. He made the call, and that triggered the note that was passed in. So what I'd like to believe is that somewhere in the United States, in a venue much like this tonight, there's a guy standing up before a microphone and saying, I used to be the head of security of the U.S. Information Agency, and I had the craziest experience one day. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.